Hello and welcome to this week's episode. I apologize for the lateness of this. I felt quite sick yesterday. I felt very, very sick, and had a bit of a to do with, we're having family difficulties, a bit of financial difficulty, and a bit of a to do with my old muff. She's already been upset because the addiction has encroached on our lives once again. And as I say, it's a family illness. It echoes outwards, reverberates is when it, but anyway, it impacts the fam as well as my mammy, who is my fammy. We're having a bit of trouble at the moment. I'm a little bit of trouble. So today I'm going to talk about Francis Bacon. Probably not just Francis Bacon. I just read the good article about him. Think about Francis Bacon. I love, you know, anyone who's got an inordinate interest in the viscera, the grotesque, somatic hemorrhaging, body distortion and effluent and the body's lower stratum, stuff I've talked about here before, we will obviously find a lot to love about Francis Bacon. And when you go and see the thing about his paintings is, when you go and see the paintings, when you go look at the paint of Francis Bacon's paint, he does an awful lot of paint with it. It always naff paint. It's like, I used to sell paintings. I did 2 years of illustration degree level, and then that drained me of any need I had to create artwork. The collegiate discipline of it all, it just drained out of me. No, I was getting like 92-94% on the art history essays. I loved that. I loved the writing and the research. I realized that is where my heart is now. So that's why I went over to English literature and creative writing, fucking smashed it. Had quite a staggered education. Took a year off to do drugs. Started another year and took another year off to do drugs. And finally did my final year, but traveled from Essex to Portsmouth 4 or 5 times a week. So I wasn't immersed in the easy accessibility of drugs, from student lifestyle. I had to really get myself away from that. I was also in a new relationship with someone who's down here. And this was when it was just about bearable. So the first 3 months. We went way over a honeymoon period. She had a bit of trouble with her family. Had to move in with my mum and dad. And it started off. There were moments. We had some nice. She's a very funny lady. We had moments, but she was amazing then. Actually, she bought me a printer, which was a lifesaver. So I could do my dissertation. Ended up getting 96%. Got high first, mate, and then student of the year. Really put my everything into that. There we go, life, eh? No, 2014 that was. And guess when I first started uni? 2008. Should have been a doctor, but it wasn't consistently, as I said, year out, year in, year out, shake it all about. Stick a needle in your arm and die inside. That's what I bloody am. Whoa, a drug addict. Whoa, a drug addict. No, I've never done needles. I've been in shooting galleries, but I have too much pride. I couldn't bring myself to go. Like, I couldn't bring myself to ask for a tutorial. Go, what are we doing with the cotton bud there? What are we doing with the bit of rubber hose in there? Bit of rubber hose. Oh, the tying off. What are you tying off, are you? Yeah, no, I wanted to be like, yeah, I know all that shit. I know exactly what to do. I just don't want to do it, though. I'm fine with my cowpole for the time being. Nah, more than cowpole. Crushing and snorting morphine tablets and down in oxycodone. Okay. But yeah, with back, like, so Praise Nowaka Matthew Smith, Bacon actually spoke of Smith's complete interlocking of image and paint, that the brushstroke creates the form and does not merely fill it in. And you see that, like, he's got a kind of a very technical grasp of painting, old Bacon. And he's not just drawing with the brush. I know what I'm trying to say, but I can't really say it. It's in the same way that you know they say, oh, in the block of clay or block of marble, the image is always there, but you're just using the ching 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 thing to find it, to discover it, to uncover it. Similar to how Francis, pardon me, uses Bacon. uses paint. Oh, he missed a trick there. Should have been Bacon who paints with Bacon. I amused myself. I'm delightful. Okay, I actually did a painting. I still love art. Such a basic bitch finger. I love. Don't hold it against me, but I love art. I do. I did one podcast recently and spoke about Paul McCarthy. For those who don't know, Paul McCarthy is a conceptual artist. He does a lot of video art. He does a lot of situationist moments. Like pranks or like happenings, that's the word, happenings, a lot of video performance. And so on this website, it's McCarthy's video performance oscillate between the comic and the grotesque, things I love, a lot more books about that, ketchup bottle standing for blood in a low blood budget show of violence. His 1995 piece, Painter, which is what I talked about on this podcast that should be out soon. Main reason, it isn't even my best piece, but it was just from what I could find on YouTube, was the thing that best represented what I love most about his work. A perverse mimicry of children's art instruction television program. McCarthy wore a blonde wig, bulbous nose, like them, you know, their monkeys. Bonobo monkeys? Yeah, bonobo monkeys. Look them up. And swollen latex hands. Using brushes as tall as himself. Used like oversized phalluses. Pivoted against his crutch. He smeared paint and condiments on giant canvases. He was surrounded by even larger paint tubes labelled red, blue, black and shit. It's very immature. Like, that's what I like about it. Very puerile. And it indulges its puerility in a very uncautious, unbridled way. It's what I love most about happy hardcore. So you've got happy hardcore songs where the lyrics are almost like embarrassingly trite and childlike, but tap into your emotional core in a very like there's songs like I Wanna Fly, Making Rainbows in the Sky, Love Never Dies, I Feel Live Forever in the Skies. It's very just, yeah, it's very Candyland sentimentality, and I love it for that reason. So I love happy hardcore. I always champion it, like the Bonkers compilations, got all of them, and I used to listen to them in my garage while painting when I was at college doing art and design. BTEC boys, BTEC boy, because I was on my own. almost 100% of the time, except for when tutors loved me. I thought I was a whiz kid, wonderkin. Except they became, you know, they became quite resistant to spending time with me when it was lunchtime. So, which, fair enough. You think they, you know, they had rules about who could come in the office. You think they could bend them a bit. I mean, it's their office. They set the rules, but they wanted to rigidly stick to that rule when I wanted to sit and eat my toasted sandwich with them. I used to bring in vodka and Coke and poured it into a Coke can, and then upgraded to vodka and oxycodone in the same Coke can. Sometimes I'd be well ahead of schedule and I'd bunk off and I'd go walk down Hadley Castle, supping from this concoction. Just go on my own, do a bit of drawing. Do a bit of sketching, and listen to the nothing special, but it was big in the time. This was 2007 or something. I listened to the Ricky Gervais podcast, the Carl Pilkington. It was actually a great time in my life. Awful, actually, outside of that, but there were nice moments. I used to draw and paint these pictures of a woman giving birth to an air vent quite a lot. I don't know why that was like a recurring theme and trope in my work. And I had to do that build. I actually became really good at sewing and stuff. So I had to create out of felt and that this backdrop of a Clockwork Orange, which was actually great. I was really happy with it. I think I've still got some pictures from that era. And I was good, man. I was good. So back to McCarthy. Yeah. Turt reducing high art to scatological play, corporally abject and puerile. And I've obviously written about this fuckloads in the old book. I'll see if I can get to some of the stuff where I've alighted upon this in the book. What's that one? On the Good Night. Actually, it might be that one. Just going down now. This is all part of it. One of the other books, whenever I've written a chapter, I've kind of draw a line underneath it for now until I can see it in its complete form and passed it on to them to edit. And then I'll edit it and then I'll pass it back to me and I can, you know, tweak and add or, you know, take away. And then there'll be a lot more back and forth. So at the moment, just let me just get in the word count down, just getting it all down. It's not in that one. And I wonder the problem is that there's a rigidity to the way these dementia and the charities and the medical. There's always a friction between the medical side of things and the holistic side of things that reminds me of the tension between the economic arguments to do with the pandemic. And then the medical arguments. And because I would believe in person-centered care, the philosophy of relationship-centered dementia care, which they, you know, they espouse as well, the medical side of things, but they're always talking about them as if they're like a unit rather than an individual. Like, this is what this kind of stimulation is what is good for everyone. Whereas we take the approach of actually some people really don't like leaving their rooms. And we can encourage them and do the right things, but when they're out of their room, they're distressed or they're they want to be back in the safety of their bedroom. Like Mari used to be like that. I take my cue from the resident. I mean, there's always a weird. I'm just looking. Okay. I think I'm worried that. I think that's about right. Yeah. Apologies. Sorry. I'll carry on talking through this. So there's always these kinds of frictions between different sides. Like in rehab, there was a bit of a friction between the medical or the psychiatrists and the therapists. And the therapist knew me as an individual. The medical staff knew me really as the documents. With the ticks on inner ticks and questionnaires, and they would do whatever they could do in that moment to mitigate my anxiety without looking at the long-term consequences. So they'd prescribe me highly addictive substances like Valium and Zopiclone to calm me down then and there, but without consulting the therapist, who go, well, okay, it's fine to do that now, but he's in here for addiction treatment. He's part of the addiction treatment program. Don't you think that might be dangerous to add another medication to the mix of something that has the potential to fuck up his recovery? And so we had a resident called John. I'm just getting on to John. So with John, he was compos mentis, apparently. He's in his early 70s with a fringe of long, greasy hair around the side of his head, faded tattoos like ink bleeding through toilet paper, and an entire body that looks nicotine stained. His movements are fretful, dogged, and sudden. Everything is done in a half sprint. And like Addy, who we meet in an earlier chapter, he seems to be perpetually tormented and restless, though eager to muck in, to not cause any additional stress for the carers. He's always making tea for other residents or gathering mugs, cups and saucers and loading them into the sink. On such occasion, Sue, a carer, who's a real sort of tart with a heart, apologies, not tart, but I've heard that expression used. She's a tart with a heart. Like I can't hate her completely. She can be a real bitch and I really can't stand her sometimes, but there's something the same, a little bit redeeming about her. He seems to be, even though she can be quite cruel, he seems to be perpetually tormented and restless. On such occasions, Sue might bark. You're actually going to wash him while she's tapping away on her phone and sitting with her feet up on a stool she's taken from Sissy, another resident. Unfortunately, because of Sue, and Sue is a carer as well. Unfortunately, because of Sue, I can't completely disabuse the stereotype of lazy carers. For some reason, he's found a sense of kinship with Mary when he gives a few quid to a carer so they can fetch him proper biscuits or sweets from the shop. He'll load half the biscuit sweets onto a saucer. Oh, fuck. That's Michael. Perfect timing, buddy. I'll have to come back to him as I'm doing this. Go listen to the Michael and Pope special bonus podcasts. Go and have a listen to them. You can hear us chatting away. We're both quite boring in conversation with each other. I think it's because we've known each other so long, but there's such a weight to our friendship that we don't feel the need to put a bit of sizzle on it. We didn't even feel the need to like spice it up for the listenership, which is why three of those episodes are the least most listened to of all the podcast episodes. Actually, one of them's been listened to a lot for some reason. It was the last one, though. People were just really relieved. Fuck, I'll give this one a go, but let's just see how this ends. Never ends that friendship. No matter how hard both of us try to end it. And this is why I should prepare. I used to prepare some old ones. Oh, yeah, so he'll give half the biscuits and sweets onto a soul sale and then pass them to Mary with her hair recently dyed, looking as if she's used a HP ink cartridge. Gypsy Mary, love Gypsy Mary. She's a very really infectious laugh, like a real sweetheart. And I'm going to play into a terrible, awful stereotype, so I apologise if I offend anyone, but her family have got about one limb between them that they share, I think. They use it as the last remaining leg as a maypole around which they congregate. Like a Swiss Army knife. And they have all the other bits coming off of the knife. They're Swiss Army gypsy. But no, they're actually a lovely family. The two little boys come in very, very sweet. And they make a real fuss over all the other residents as well. You can tell they're family oriented in that way. And in a lot of closed society groups, they treat their elders very well. The elders, they're responsible. Everyone's responsible for the community's elders. You see that in Quakerism as well, which I'll maybe talk about in a bit. Mary always accepts this kind offering without a single word exchanged. The final two awake, left for the night staff, as they say. They'll watch TV in the lounge and work their way through the treats, barely acknowledging each other's presence. Occasionally, she might pat him on the hand and say, "Thanks, Dad, looking up the old gulps tomorrow." And I can't, that's not an infectious laugh. She'll go, "No, I can't do one." She's got a really lovely infectious laugh, a big gruff laugh. This is another thing I love about these environments, these tender little rituals that arise organically without any instruction or forward planning. Small acts of kindness and protection, like John springing up and rushing to the bathroom to get Mary some tissues. And from then on, they become embedded, part of a shared routine and a platonic relationship of sorts. That's what it is with John and Mary. I don't know if he reminds her of someone, but he's semi with it. Like, you wouldn't actually think for a guy who hoards piss, but like me, but I have my own mad ritual. So number one, I always have a copy of Becoming Richard Pryor by Scott Sowell in my rucksack. So before every gig, I flatten my hand against the cover, and this is very like, "Oh, your boyfriend loves Bill Hicks," but I flatten my hand against the cover as a sort of blessing to honour the high priest of confessional stand-up comedy, which is extremely pathetic. Again, before I leave the house to travel to a gig, Mum and I sing this song, me reluctantly, her enthusiastically, where we recite, "Break a leg, break a leg, break a leg, woo!" and finish with a leg pop and a woo, which is also extremely pathetic, but that's Mum's. She has to do it. She's really big into superstitions. She worries that if I have a bad gig, have bad mental health. If I have bad mental health, I'll unravel and start using to stay calm. After every breakdown, I go jogging as the sun is setting beside the motorway near my house. Or this is, say after every breakdown, it's more just if I'm restless and it's summer. And the vanishing point at the end of the motorway happens to align perfectly with the setting sun. So I try to complete the length of the motorway before the sun fucks off. Basically, I'm trying to outrun the sun. Yeah, and there's a couple more I've got as well. These free Franks. I'll show you one of them, so I don't want to muck them up. They're Russian Orthodox panels that I got from Alexander Nevsky Cathedral in Estonia. And because I'm not Russian Orthodox, I can't read the writing on there. Cyrillic script. Cyrillic script. I can't read it because I'm not Russian now.
Cyrillic
script, yeah. So I just call them all Frank after my granddad. And I pray to the Franks on... if I'm expecting news and stuff, usually I pray to the Franks. And the perennial sweet corn, which I've spoken about before, and people don't really get it. They think it's weird. It's like this morning I said, I'm a royalist against my better judgment. Not so much now due to the treatment, and as I believe, the racially charged treatment against Meghan. But before that, I mean, Dinah died when I was 7. I still remember as well. It was on a holiday in Spain. I still remember. It's ingrained into my memory. But because my mum refers to the William and Harry as those boys, it's this royalist part of myself been inculcated into it by my mother. But I was a royalist because I liked the unbroken chain to the past, which I feel is what the perennial sweet corn represents, in that it was a sweet corn. I found it exactly the same place under a hoarder's sofa. And obviously, it was dry as anything and it was still there. I like to think it's still there now. And it's like the faraway god. Actually, wait on that. It's all part of it. Because this faraway god, I've spoken about it, haven't read it, in a book about Samuel Beckett and theology. But I've never properly explained it because I couldn't find the book to refer to. I'm just looking for it. If I can't find it, I'll tell you the basics. I can't find it. The faraway god was, it's just a god who created everything, created all his creation, created everything we know, and then looked out the window and turned away. And a faraway god, yeah, just got to looks out the window. And he's had enough of all that shit. He made it, he put it aside, left it to dry. Now he's sitting having a rest. And that's the faraway god. He doesn't intervene. When people go, why does he let cancer kids get dead? Why does he get cancer kids dead? Why does he die? Why does he die the cancer kids? Why does he die? Why does he like Mary's hair? Why does he kill kids? He doesn't do anything. He's not part of it. He just made this and looked out the window. He made this and vaped. Maiden and Vate, made the world, made the entire universe, made every material and immaterial phenomenon in existence, and then vaped and had a Kit Kat break, which he also made. And where was I? Oh, yeah. So it's what I love about these these late relationships, these little rituals that arise organically, and then they just become embedded. They become part of the routine and a platonic relationship of sorts. He also has elaborate conversations with himself, old John, perched on the edge of his mattress, bouncing slightly with his soles pressing into the laminate boards and making roll-ups that should last him until the end of the day, until the next day, but never do. When I put my head around the door, Johnny, Johnny, rubber Johnny, he'll acknowledge it. He'll acknowledge that he's talking to no one, and point blank, he'll ask, "A bit mad, isn't it, talking to yourself? I'm a bit mad for doing that, aren't I?" "Honestly, don't worry about it, John," I'll reassure him. Sometimes this place can send you a bit bloody crazy. Like, you know, I start muttering to myself as well. But if you're bored and feeling a bit agitated, you know you can always come and chat to me. It'll never be an imposition. When he takes me up on this offer, he'll throw out these baroque and barely concealed lies. Actually, more tall tales than lies. I might be sitting in the lounge, filling out some charts, and suddenly he'll storm into the room and plonk himself in the chair beside me. Like any segue, and his usual breathless and unpunctuated delivery, he'll say, "I worked for the Queen and defused a bomb. I found the Mercedes and it was planted there by the IRA and Saddam Hussein." I go, "Oh, that's mad, John. You've actually had a storied life," I'd say. I'd reply, playing along. "I killed them all and drove them to the Isle of Wight and threw them off the cliff, and I got a purple heart for that. And so it ended up being a nice day, all told. Anyway, I have my sandwiches in my room." Then, as quickly as he'd arrived, he'd be gone again. I had a friend who acted like this, similar to an overexcited child, who's also a first-rate fabulist. But because it was obvious he was telling porkies and ones that were so over the top, and he made little effort to convince me of the verisimilitude of the things he was saying, I let it go. In fact, I was quite charmed by it. Turned out this friend had a benign tumour slumped on part of his brain, causing him to act irrationally. I thought it was a quirk or a lack of socialisation in his formative years. He ended up being sectioned. I never saw him again. True story. He ended up thinking he was... I better not go into details because I haven't said his name, have I? He ended up saying that he was a paedophile, and that there was helicopters all around him, and this big conspiracy out to get him. I spoke to his brother concerned. I think it's out there anyway, but I haven't said his name or particularly his identity and stuff. Yeah, no, I need to follow up on that. The problem is I was in a bad way afterwards. So I'd relapsed and I was all fucked up and I didn't want to, I found it very difficult to accommodate what is severe mental illness, because I used to be his like surrogate mum for a while, like in university. Because, I mean, he's sweet. He was a sweetheart. Actually, you know, as far as we know, he doesn't have, he's not a paedophile or anything like that. But if he says that in his psychosis, like, is that something? Like, he asked his brother and said, like, what is the police after him? And the brother said, no, it's all just, he'd seen, like, a news story about that. And it now had factored into his psychotic episode, but then did it factor in because he has some, like, you know, dormant did he have some, like, I don't know, did he have, there was that part of his, did he have like deviant sexual desires? I don't know. That was another reason I just thought, I can't, like, this guy's very, very unwell. And from everything the brother's telling me, like, he's not, he was like a child in and of himself. He really was. He was like a skinned Winnie the Pooh. I said he looks like got kind of a constellation of burst capillaries where he, like, obviously his liver's erupting or something. But then, yeah, like little sort of bear like face and actions, and yeah, Ade just very sad, very sad. I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know what to do with that information and how to be a friend to that person. And I still felt like there were gaps in what him and the brother. I mean, he was just telling me some bonkers stuff, but the brother was, you know, being candid and open with me. Their identity is protected. It's not anyone you'd know or anything like that. Anyway, it's just very sad. In our dealings with him, it turned out. But according to various assessments, John has capacity, the old man, the John actually has capacity. He even handles his own finances. So in our dealings with him, we're always straddling a fine line between respecting his autonomy and preserving his health and well-being. Also known as beneficence, that tension is part of the job. He often refuses to wash or change his clothes, so all we can do is encourage him or unofficially incentivize washing and dressing. He arrived as one of the unbefriended, flanked by harried social workers brandishing folders full of documentation, one with glasses and flyaway hairs sticking out of a sagging bun, the other with short, sharp hairstyle and mauve lipstick. Lesbians, John said to me on the first day after they'd left, or sisters. Not that I've got a problem with either. Like, it's like he has to assure me that the concept of sisters and lesbians isn't anything he, you know, he's an open-minded guy. He doesn't, sisters, let people be, love is love. Let people be sisters. I mean, lesbians, on the other hand, no, not for me. No, I'm joking. My cousin's, I'm just playing John. My cousin is a lesbian, and she was married to a woman for a while. And if you're listening to this, Lindsay, I love you very much, and we should meet up for a coffee soon. If I haven't seen each other for a long time. I'm so shit at staying in contact with anyone, and very antisocial, which at the moment is sort of something that's been enforced due to government regulation, but even when it wasn't, that's why I am one of those idiot people who said it has got to me, and it has really kind of felt like a seagull, you know, come over and shitting all over my plans. But it wasn't like a drastic upheaval for me. My life has mainly stuck to the same routine, except not being able to gig, which is, my whole life was kind of ordered around my gig schedule. And initially there's a little bit more freedom actually to with that not being the case, but I miss it so much. Soon became apparent that his daughter Trisha works upstairs on the top floor. She didn't want to see him, though he knew she was there, and mentioned it with pride in his voice. They'd been estranged for years, and Leslie are a reliable source of gossip and a big, larger-than-life character in this book. Someone, again, I love very much, even though she's got her ways. Asked him some scandalous details. He pulled a gun on Trisha's mum when she was a kid. He was a drunk. He was a wrong'un. Keep an eye on him. If he tries it at me, I'm locking him in a medicine trolley, she said. Or if he's got a gun, I replied. Yeah, between the knuckles. Yeah, I'm sure that's going to withstand a gun, Leslie. We're regularly confronted with the evident fallibility of man. Marilynne Robinson, in an essay entitled Grace, refers to Prospero's speech to his treacherous, slanderous brother Antonio in the fifth act of The Tempest. Antonio is at Prospero's mercy, she writes, and the mercy he receives is perfect, insisted upon in these repetitions, qualified only by the fact that in no case does it forget, minimize, or extenuate his crimes. I propose that Shakespeare is turning over a theological problem here. How do forgiveness and grace not deprive evil of its nature, its gravity? Back to me. The meat of an NA meeting is a series of auricular confessions, minus the attendant absolution. And sometimes the people in these meetings are holding their hands up to truly despicable acts. It's against the spirit of the thing to reveal specifics, but domestic abuse, sadly, is a common offence. I'm gutting that. There can also be harmless confessions that I once admitted to participating in cannibalism sex chat. Standard dom sub shit. It was initiated by the woman I was seeing, and I didn't really get it, so I sent her a text reading, "I'm going to swallow your boobs." Nothing else. And she followed up with, "Yeah, maybe this isn't your thing." So dom to cannibalism does sex chat. Yeah, I can do that. Oh yeah, I love them boobs. They're lovely, big milky, glistening boobs. I'm gonna swallow them down. I'm gonna swallow them down. I'm gonna smear them on a Ryvita and eat and swallow your boobs. Gonna masticate all over your boobs. Teeth jokes. I instinctively recoil when I hear such revelations. I thought his geese was all right. But we're in a town hall or a repurposed gymnasium, holding on to a cup of lukewarm tea and sacrificing an evening watching Netflix as a necessary step towards redemption. Or when the perpetrator alludes to past misconduct to open on something pure and grander than mercy, something that puts aside the consciousness of fault, the residue of judgment that makes mercy a lesser thing than grace. In my capacity as a carer, I've scanned the communal areas of the care home and asked myself, how many of these old men have beaten their wives? How many of these frail and shrunken people have ostracized black neighbors or spat racist abuse at new arrivals? It's a dark thought, but they're a product of an era when young men returned from war as stammering, traumatized souls, at least internally, and ones who are unable to summon the language of psychic disturbance, or a time in which majoritarian whiteness was seen as a form of manifest destiny, and the upheavals of civil rights, of dark as hell, and the black struggle in Britain hadn't yet altered race relations in the UK. You see, I've said altered rather than improved upon or something, because it's not really for me to judge. What I would say is that there's now a latency to racism. The stuff that was over, maybe again, this has probably shifted a bit since Trump. It's probably gone back to sort of brazen and overt, but not as brazen as and overt as it was in the 50s, arguably. But then some people say, is that, I don't know whether that's a good thing. At least you know where you stand with that. Whereas passive aggressive racism, like what we're seeing in some of the commentary around Meghan Markle, it's just still racism, isn't it? It still has the same consequence. Comedian Dane Baptiste actually has an incredible routine called Fuck Your Nan that upends the saccharine grandparents say the darndest thing. Image of old white people who tells us to kill your nan, fuck your fucking nan. It's a really good routine. Go check that out. Just write Dane Baptiste. What did I say it was called again? Fuck your nan. Fuck your nan. That's it. Who's to know? These details are scrubbed from the potted biography we're given by family members. I tend not to lead with, is Dad a vehement racist? If he is, then his old knob will not be getting washed. At least to the not to the exacting standard I'm known for. Old knobs aside, I hope that with each subsequent generation, the harm of what came before will be burned off like sulfur impurities. But on an individual level, on a cellular level, the effects of aging diminish a person and whatever evil has been committed by them in the past. It'd be like squaring up to a mushroom to confront it now. There's always a path to salvation, and even if they get to a point where they're old and decrepit and haven't taken it, they're going to discover a newfound innocence in senility, be cared for by African, Eastern European and Filipino workers, and most likely die under strip lighting with only me for company. Me sitting by their beds, moistening their lips with a glycerin swab, talking about how I've run out of mini eggs, which is a reference to a bit earlier on in the chapter. Imagine that. Imagine my face being the last face you ever see. That's when justice is restored. And then just as a little footnote, I say, it's weird to think there's approximately 10 people who've died with me beside them, or shortly after I'd left the room. With one of them, I rested my copy of the London Review of Books on their blanketed legs while I read it. I did ask him first, but using the dying man as a lectern, a bit morally perilous, isn't it? Anyway, so we went around the houses a bit, but back to Francis Bacon. And speaking of aging, so it's weird, like Francis Bacon, he's part of, I've noticed there's like people who talk about people of the past. I sort of say, oh, he was a looker. I loved, he had a kind of a marvelous face, a beautiful, handsome man. Right, and they're like they're not even like by today's standard. They're just not like someone said. I like to remember Francis Bacon's beautiful pansy shaped face. You've seen his face. You can tell that's a man who gets sexual excitement from strangulation because it looks like his neck's been strangled and he's like big tumor head, got a big fat tumor head with a strangulated tumor like big cyst head. Got a big old cyst face. Imagine that hovering over you. And then when he used to go out, this was so I enjoyed watching Francis make up his face. He applied the basic foundation with lightning dexterity born of long practice. He was more careful, even sparing, with the rouge. For his hair, he had a selection of kiwi boot polishes in various browns. He blended these on the back of his hand, selecting a tone appropriate for the particular evening, and brushed them through his abundant hair with a shoe brush. He polished his teeth with vim. He looked remarkably young, even before the alchemy. Then makeup firmly in place. Bacon went about Soho each evening, insulting people and using obscene words. So you've got this man, it's like someone has, it's like a stained strangulated bollock, like a strangulated bollock with all this shit smeared all over its face, going around going, oh, boo boo be doo, oh you foul slag, how you doing poppet, oh boo be doo, you're right you big old fat fuck, boo boo be doo, oh kissy 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 wissy wissy woo woo, kissy wissy woo woo, you fat greasy, ugly, lolling, big old piece of fucking whore. Boo, boo, be doo. Oh, look at that one. She's got a neck like a thigh. Fat, fucking, ugly cunt. Boo, boo, boo. Boo, be doo. And you're like, why am I choosing to spend time with that? Kiss, kiss. And it's like, oh my God, like, like bright red cheek fucking shoe polish in his hair. He's painted his fucking hair on. You're beautifying a tumor. I mean, what on earth? Look at that big fat cyst head. You can see the veins inside it. Trying to cover it up with rouge and then going around calling everyone a dirty old pig. All you fat old filthy pig. All you fat old filthy pig. Better. I don't even know what I'm saying anymore. Doesn't sound like good company, is what I'm saying. It sounds awful. Sounds like an awful fella. A piece of shit. Oh, yeah, big. Oh, look, Alan. Hello. Hello. Sorry. He gets scared. He's such a nervous dog. If my dog is anything to go by, I'm going to be a terrible father. I ignore him most of the day, and then I love him until he's scared. Oh, dear. And then I feed him a treat to get him off my back. You're lovely, Alan. Sorry. See, if you're patreon.com/pope.lonergan. If you had your Patreon, like some fella from a lovely bloke from New Zealand. Oh, sorry, Alan. Sorry. I just hit him in the face. Shit. Sorry, Alan. You would be able to see my dog and plenty of other stuff besides. Oh, sorry, Alan. Who's a good boy? Who's a lovely boy? Who's a lovely, lovely boy? Yeah, it's a good boy. I think he got scared. He thought I was shouting. I wasn't shouting. I was just doing the podcast. Oh, whoa, whoa. Oh, whoa, whoa, whoa. Look at you, you dangly white piece of fuck. Yeah, I mean, it's been all right, isn't it? This episode, I think I'll start preparing some more stuff as well, and give it a bit more structure. Unless you like it like this, yeah, let me know. Always happy to hear your feedback, and go on Patreon. Trust me, you get loads more of this shit. patreon.com/pope.lonergan. And please buy a ticket to next up, Being Jewish UK Comedy Edition with David Baddiel, Rachel Krieger, Meryl O'Rourke, Andrea Huber, and Philip Simon. And then your wonderful chair or host, Davina Bentley. And go there. It'll be funny, but it'll be really insightful. And it'll do a lot better than what they did on Politics Live, in that it will actually be Jewish people talking about Jewish issues, but then it'll be celebratory as well as talk about the specific contours of anti-Semitism and stuff like that. So please, I urge you, I've organized it, but none of the money is going to me. It's all going to the acts. The kind of Jewish commentary we want, which is from Jewish people. I've got Jewish matrilineage, but it goes two generations back. It hasn't informed my identity in any way other than I've got a big interest in Judaism and Hasidism and all that kind of stuff. So, but anyway, yeah, it will be a great show. So that's the 10th of March, Wednesday, the 10th of March at 7 p.m. Go to Next Up's website or just look at David Baddiel's Twitter and there'll be links to it and stuff. Yeah, love you all. Bye-bye.